Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we bring you two segments. One, regarding press freedom issues and Ted Rall versus the Los Angeles Times. And the other involves nuclear terror today. It's a reminder of how we still face nuclear annihilation despite the Cold War's alleged ending. Stay tuned.
Perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Do we have a right to a jury trial in the United States? Particularly, are journalists protected from corporate media and their powerful allies? In this segment of the Project Censored Show, we're in conversation with editorial cartoonist and journalist Ted Rall, talking about his recent case, Ted Rall versus the Los Angeles Times. In this segment of the program, we are rejoined by the author, journalist, and editorial cartoonist Ted Rall. You can learn more at rall.com, RALL.com. Ted Rall is a political cartoonist at anewdomain.net, editor-in-chief at skewednews.net, a graphic novelist and author of many books of art and prose. His most recent works with Seven Stories Press include Snowden, Bernie, also Trump, a graphic biography, and most recently Francis, the People's Pope. Ted Rall, thanks for coming back on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, Mickey.
Although I have to say that it is very unfortunate why we are having you back on the Project Censored Show. And for the segment today, you're going to be talking all about the ruling in Ted Rall versus Los Angeles Times et al. That ruling came down mid-January. You recently wrote a piece, "You No Longer Have the Right to a Jury Trial." Whatever do you mean?
Fewer than 0.5% of American civil lawsuits ever get to see a jury. And if you wonder how that comes to be, my case is an example of that. I was the editorial cartoonist at the LA Times for 6 years, from 2009 to 2015. And during that time, of course, I did hundreds of cartoons, and I did some that were critical of the LAPD and its police chief, Charlie Beck. In 2014, about a year before I got fired by the LA Times, the LA Times parent company, Tribune Publishing, which was also called Tronc, ended up getting into a financial arrangement with the LAPD pension fund. A new publisher came on board at the LA Times, a guy named Austin Buettner, who will be familiar to people who followed the recent LA teachers strike. He's now the superintendent of schools there. Buettner's a billionaire hedge fund guy, and he midwifed a deal to put some money into the pockets of Tronc. He arranged for the LAPD pension fund, which is worth $16 billion, to become the number one shareholder of Tribune Publishing, which owns the LA Times and 14 other newspapers. So effectively, the police department in LA owned the LA Times and all these other papers. I didn't know any of this, and nobody told me that I should lay off the cops. I don't think my editors knew what was going on either. But in 2015, suddenly out of the blue, the LA Times contacted me and said that they had received from the LAPD an audio recording of a jaywalking stop that I had been arrested for in 2001, 14 years earlier. Now, you might be asking yourself, why is this relevant? Well, I had done a cartoon about the LAPD crackdown against jaywalking in poorer areas of Los Angeles and how they disproportionately affected poor people and people of color with $200 fines, which were prohibitive. And as part of the cartoon, the LATimes.com website published my blog, which explained the cartoon and talked about how I had been arrested myself, mistreated by a police officer, and that the mistreatment had included handcuffing and had attracted a group of onlookers, some of whom became angry and shouted at the police officer. Now, that happened back in 2001. I wrote about it in 2015, and 2 months later, the LA Times claimed that the LAPD had given them a secret audio recording taken by the cop of my arrest that showed that, in fact, I had not been handcuffed or mistreated in any way. And so less than 23 hours later, they arranged to publish a piece that stated that I was a liar and a fabulist and announcing my firing. About a week later, I arranged to have the audio enhanced, which means cleaned up. If you watch the CSI shows, they take the noise out, the traffic noise, wind, and that kind of stuff. And when they cleaned it up, it was still pretty bad in terms of its quality. But you could hear women and other people shouting at the police officer with sexual innuendo and other insults. And among other things, saying, take off his handcuffs. So this vindicated my side of the story, and I contacted my former editors at the LA Times, and they completely went, la, 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 I can't hear you. They didn't reply. They wouldn't get back to me. I called. I wrote. They just wouldn't get back. They were ignoring me because they obviously were not very interested in knowing the truth, because they had fired me as a favor to the police chief, Charlie Beck, who was effectively the boss of the new publisher. And also, I should say that Beck and Buettner were close political allies. Buettner, now the superintendent in L.A., wants to be mayor of L.A. or governor of California, but has basically no political support in California. Angelenos don't know him or like him. He just can't get the votes. His only political ally at the time was the LAPD as a result of this pension fund thing. Anyway, there was no way they were going to take me back. After I did the enhancement, I posted it to social media and to my website, and the word got out, and some media outlets started doing their own enhancements and their own coverage. The Guardian, New York Observer, the independent journalist Greg Palast, they did their own enhancements and got the same results. And pretty soon, lots of people, including the head of the Nieman Foundation, which is a very well-respected journalistic organization, were calling for me to be restored to my position at the LA Times. And the LA Times was feeling the heat in a big way. And after 3 weeks, they doubled down with a second piece, again, reaffirming, as they said, their decision to fire me. This time, they said that they had actually finally done their own enhancements, and they couldn't hear anything. Now, the funny thing about that is a friend got in touch with one of their so-called experts who told her that, in fact, the LA Times never did hire him, and that the reason he couldn't hear anything is because he had never been paid to enhance the audio. The LA Times lied about what he said. So that's where things stood. I sued for defamation and libel and wrongful termination.
To remind listeners, you were technically fired for lying about jaywalking that you didn't lie about.
Correct. I mean, like, let's put this into perspective.
Yeah.
Even if I had done what they said,
right,
most media organizations would not have fired me for this.
What's
so
absurd?
Like, what they alleged was that I mischaracterized a police officer as being rude to me as opposed to being polite. And that's the extent of the lie, according to them. And it was not even in the print edition. It was in a blog that only appeared online, which is in the opinion section, which means you have a lot more latitude. So even if I had done exactly what they said, which, of course, I didn't, most media organizations at most would have warned me to be careful and not to do that again. Maybe I would have been suspended for a month. I think that's about as extreme as it would get. So not only did they fire me, but they published these two articles characterizing me as a liar and a fabulist, obviously in the hopes that I would never work again. The same way that a butcher who doesn't wash his hands is probably not going to get a lot of work, a journalist who is known as a liar is also not going to get a lot of work. So they were trying to send a message clearly to journalists throughout Southern California not to mess with the LAPD. So I filed suit. I wanted them to do the right thing. I gave them time to do the right thing. But after 9 months, I had to do something because the statute of limitations would have run out. So 9 months later, I filed suit in L.A. Superior Court. And the first thing that L.A. Times did was file something called an anti-slap motion. And the theory of anti-slap is that a slap is a lawsuit that is filed solely with the intent of harassing the defendant into having to spend a lot of money on legal fees, and that the deep-pocketed wealthy plaintiff, in this case me, is only trying to drive the poor, indigent Los Angeles Times, which is worth $500 million and whose publisher is worth $9 billion, into bankruptcy through frivolous litigation. That's the theory of the slap.
I'm speaking with the editorial cartoonist and journalist Ted Rall. We're talking about his recent case against the Los Angeles Times. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. And after this musical break, we're going to continue our conversation with Ted Rall. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are speaking in this segment with Ted Rall, the editorial cartoonist and journalist. He's been on the Project Censored Show several times to talk about his graphic books. He's done a lot of these with Seven Stories Press in New York, Snowden, another called Bernie on Bernie Sanders, Trump, a graphic biography, and the most recent one is Francis, the People's Pope. These are all by Ted Rall. You can learn more at rall.com, RALL.com. And Ted Rall, just before the break, you were explaining the SLAPP issue. That's S-L-A-P-P. And just for listeners that don't know, that stands for Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. And again, this goes back, stemming from the RICO days, going back to the 70s, and this was something that was a big thing of the 80s. Did you want to say anything, Ted, historically about that?
It's interesting. There's absolutely no empirical evidence, peer-reviewed study, or even just good long feature piece of journalism that makes the case that there is such a thing as a slap phenomenon, where there's all these plaintiffs suing people, not hoping to win lawsuits, and not being able to get rid of these frivolous lawsuits in another way. Motions for summary judgment, which is the first thing that any good defense lawyer goes for, gets rid of most frivolous lawsuits. I personally have used them against plaintiffs. It just gets rid of a case in very short order. So the idea that there's this mountain of frivolous lawsuits out there is kind of just, it's completely unsubstantiated. And so as often happens with legislatures, they have solved a problem that may not even exist. Supporters of the law say that this is meant to be used by poor or not deep-pocketed individuals, whistleblowers.
Not the people who own the LA Times.
Now, the problem is, you know, in the United States, you can't create separate classes of plaintiffs and defendants based on income. So corporations are people, right? There's nothing to stop a large corporation from using that to crush an individual. That's what the Times does routinely with anti-slap motions. Lots of media organizations do. In fact, the lawyer for the LA Times is named Kelly Sager. She works for a large union crushing firm down in LA. It's with offices all around the world. And she represents the National Enquirer, and she filed an anti-slap motion against Richard Simmons, the fitness guru, because the National Enquirer falsely published a piece saying that he had transitioned to becoming a woman. He had not, and he sued for defamation. So she filed an anti-slap, and as a result of the anti-slap, Richard Simmons lost his case, got it thrown out of court, and has been ordered to pay Kelly Sager and the National Enquirer $130,000. Now, he's the victim. They published lies about him, and he's going to have to pay them. And that's the same thing that happened to me here. The LA Times filed an anti-slap. They convinced the judges down in LA using some pretty ridiculous arguments, not to mention brazen lies under oath, to overlook the most basic principle of the anti-slap statute, which is that the court at that stage is supposed to engage in a theoretical discussion with themselves. Assuming that everything the plaintiff alleges to be true, and assuming that nothing the defendant says is true, is there the bare minimum of any case at all worth that could possibly prevail at trial? If so, the case should survive anti-slap and begin discovery. But very few judges actually do that. You know, it's judges gonna judge, and judges can't help themselves. So they weigh the evidence. They kind of pre-try the case. Now, this is a violation of your right to a jury trial, something that's been enshrined in Anglo-Saxon law for over 800 years since the Magna Carta. But it's been taken away, and Americans really haven't noticed this. And even if you have the resources that I do, which is to say a sizable fan base and people who are willing to contribute money, I raised one of the things that the LA Times made me do was file a bond to guarantee their legal fees should they prevail. And it was a $75,000 cash bond. I was able to do that through a GoFundMe because I have a lot of readers who support me. But, you know, most people can't do that. Most people can't pay $75,000 just for the chance to maybe get justice. They hear about it and they walk away.
So, Ted Rall, according to your recent piece, the court has ordered you to pay the Times $330,000 for their legal fees.
That's right. I now have a judgment for $330,000. I have to pay the LA Times. The LA Times, by the way, is currently owned by a biotech billionaire worth $7 billion. His name is Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, and he gets a lot of positive press in both liberal and conservative outlets. But anyway, yeah, I have to pay Dr. Pat $330,000. It's going to be more because that was only to get to what they call the trial court stage. We litigated up to the appellate stage, which means it's going to be hundreds of thousands of dollars more than that. Look, if there's any doubt here, I'm not Charles Schulz. I don't have that money. I can't pay it. I'm never going to be able to pay it. I mean, this means bankruptcy for me for sure. So the thin reed of a possibility that the California Supreme Court will hear my case, but it's probably not going to happen. They don't hear many cases at all. They hear fewer than 5% of appellate cases that are petitioned for review. So this is probably it for me. And it's pretty wacky because I'm the victim. You know what I mean? The Times lied about me. And all I wanted was the chance to clear my name. And I'm never going to get that. Not to mention, this sends a pretty chilling message to journalists.
Like you write in your piece, if you do your jobs, we will crush you. This is a shot across the bow. Like you said, you have enough stature in you know, the world you inhabit. People know who you are. You're known as an editorial cartoonist, an author, a journalist. That's going to be a chilling effect. I'm glad you mentioned Patrick Soon-Shiong and, of course, the Tronc, $500 million Tronc Corporation, now owned by $7 billion biotechnology entrepreneur. So that's who owns the Times and those other newspapers. The LAPD is notorious for various degrees of corruption, torture, criminal activity, etc. Why don't you tell our listeners, what was one of the arrangements that seemed to take place there involving retirement investments?
The LAPD pension fund is worth about $16 billion. And what they did is they funneled some of that money through a company in Beverly Hills called Oaktree Capital. And then Oaktree Capital, they became number one shareholder of Tribune, which is /Tronc, and that company owns the LA Times. So it's what they did was the LAPD basically said, we will prop up your lagging, crappy newspaper stock. in exchange for favorable coverage in your paper.
Again, it's the LAPD. There's a history of them running into problems in the communities that they police. And of course, the LA Times should have an obligation to cover that. Journalists should be doing their job covering it. You were certainly doing your job as an editorial cartoonist, making commentary about law and order issues and against social justice issues in LA that involve the police. The reason I'm bringing this up for background is that you're not the only one, of course, that's drawn the ire of Beck and the LAPD. More recently, the People versus Malina Abdullah. She's an African-American professor at CSU Los Angeles. She's involved with Black Lives Matter. And, of course, her case is looking interesting as well. But it's definitely another case where you're seeing people like Beck and others at the LAPD target people for their viewpoints, for their activism, and in this case, even, it looks like, for academic freedom issues. So there is some overlap with what you're doing in terms of the First Amendment, free press issues. These people didn't like what you had to say, and they basically did what they could to try to get rid of you or keep you quiet while teaching others a lesson at the same time.
And by the way, there's a history of this kind of thing. The LAPD pension fund that I mentioned purchased the San Diego Union-Tribune in 2009. And then, amazingly, you can still find this on the LA Times website of all places, there you have the LAPD pension fund head demanding that anyone who writes for the paper who's anti-police be fired. And they did get some people fired. So there's a history of this. These are people who should be in prison, not running a newspaper.
Their cozy connection with the police union, the money behind it, the pensions. There's a lot going on behind this that shows the motivation. And you write in your piece that you're luckier than people like Jamal Khashoggi. But this scorched earth litigation, you call this scorched earth litigation tactics. This is used by the National Enquirer and LA Times attorney Kelly Sager. Basically, what you're saying is that these people are getting away with silencing you. I'm assuming that you're going to try to continue as far as you can take this case.
Yeah, absolutely. Mickey, there is a systemic problem with the anti-SLAPP statute that's been perverted from something that was marketed as a way to defend the First Amendment into a way to crush journalists and make them bankrupt. And we're not just talking about me or Richard Simmons. It happens every single day, not only in California, but also in the 26 other states that have anti-SLAPP laws. Most Americans live in states with anti-SLAPP laws, although two states did overturn it as unconstitutional, specifically because it does deny plaintiffs their constitutional right to a jury trial. But unfortunately, they're harder to get rid of than an STD. They're just with us.
And your attorney made arguments during the proceedings about the anti-SLAPP. Is that correct?
Both of my attorneys are big fans of the anti-SLAPP statute. They love it. They think it's a great law, and they don't think it applies to me. And if you read the law and the case law, it really doesn't. But you have the judges who are totally in the pockets of the LA Times and the LAPD. We're talking former prosecutors and people who hang out with people like Charlie Beck. And they're just not going to rule. So, you know, it's kind of like that decision with the code of silence cops in Chicago, where the judge was just turning cartwheels in order to prevent herself from telling the obvious truth, which is that their colleague murdered that kid. This was the same kind of thing. I mean, it was embarrassing to listen to. My lawyer pointed out that they are supposed to take my enhanced audio as expert evidence because it came from a separate organization. And they said, well, Ted Rall says he can hear that. That doesn't mean anything. Well, first of all, actually, under the anti-SLAPP statute, it does. But lots of other people can hear it, too. Thousands of people have listened to it online. Radio hosts, including right-wing conservatives down in L.A., have listened to it. And these are not my fans. And they said, yeah, they can hear it. Now, not everyone can hear it because, you know, it's a very low quality. And anyone who knows about audio knows that some frequencies are harder to hear. But the fact is that it's on there.
This is commonplace. I mean, in the Kent State shootings issue with Stuart Allen a number of years ago, he had enhanced audio tape of the shootings to hear someone shooting a gun prior to the guard. And that has taken a long time for anybody to bother to pay any attention to. It got minor attention over at CNN. This was several years ago. But you had mentioned earlier we were chatting about CSI. And I mean, people in this country are aware that this technology exists. So were you able to use any of this in your proceeding?
It's all been entered as evidence, and we have expert transcripts been prepared. So this is expert stuff. You know, I didn't make this up. And they're just pretending like it doesn't even exist and that there's no evidence whatsoever on my side. And they did exactly the opposite of what they're supposed to do. They believed everything that the LA Times said, even giving them credit for stuff that they didn't even allege that they did. And then they've completely disregarded everything that my team put together in terms of rock solid evidence and just, you know, shoot it away.
So, Ted Rall, what are the next steps for you, number one? And number two, what can you tell people who want to get involved or find out more or might be able to assist in your case in any way?
The next step is we are currently preparing a petition to the California Supreme Court. It's a Hail Mary pass. We would have to convince the court, not that I got screwed, but that there is a systemic misapplication of the anti-SLAPP statute throughout the court system in California. Now, that happens to be true. So hopefully they will rule the right way. But the odds of them even hearing the case are slim to none. So odds are they will reject it. If they don't reject it, then the judgments are waived. The sun rises in the east. I go and get ready for trial, which will be great. But more likely, I'm going to have a $600,000 judgment against me. They're going to freeze my bank accounts. Every time I deposit a dime into them, they're going to take it. So I'm going to have to either declare bankruptcy and or leave the United States so that I can bank overseas and be able to work overseas. And I guess I'll be an anti-SLAPP exile. If someone wants to help, they can provide financial support at either patreon.com/Ted Rall or at gofundme.com/Ted Rall, or they can donate directly through my website, rall.com. I also need some help with some legal research. So if anybody is legally or journalistically inclined and has a few hours to donate in the next couple of weeks, I would love to hear from them. They can reach me through my website. Just click contact and I will get their email and I will reply right away. And also, if people want to write to First Amendment organizations, newspapers, magazines, anyone that they have influence with to break the national media blackout in my case, that would be really great. I mean, I think the light of day, the truth is what I want to get out. And there's been a complicity on the part of mainstream corporate media to keep this completely under wraps because they don't want people to start questioning these anti-SLAPP statutes that give them tremendous power to commit acts of libel and defamation with impunity.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the case. I'm glad you mentioned the issue of corporate personhood and how that basically flips this on its head, and it's being used against you, who actually is the victim of the situation.
Yeah, even if we give the California legislature and the other legislatures that passed anti-SLAPP statutes credit, this is a classic example of the law of unintended consequences. This is not what legislatures were told that they were voting for. They were told that they were voting for something that would be used to protect people like me, not screw them over.
We've been speaking for this segment with the editorial cartoonist, journalist, author Ted Rall. You can learn more at rall.com. His recent piece on his website is You No Longer Have the Right to a Jury Trial, where he links and talks about the many issues that we just hashed out here today on the Project Censored show. And again, Ted, not only do we have you on because, you know, been a longtime ally and supporter of the great work you've done and the books you've done, certainly for Seven Stories Press, but also because this is not getting a lot of media attention. And I suspect it's because other corporate media outlets don't mind the outcome.
They're very happy with the outcome. And so I appreciate Project Censored a lot. And thank you very much for having me on and allowing me to tell my story. It's really great.
Well, Ted Rall, we'll definitely be keeping up with you and we'll check in here in the next couple of months and see how things are going and have you back on the program. This is the Project Censored Show, and I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In the second half of the program, I'll be joined by our co-host, Chase Palmieri, and we'll learn about the nuclear terror threat today. That's coming up after this musical break.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, in this segment, we are joined by two activists who are involved in a new movement called Nuclear Terror Today. We are joined by Kenneth Dubroff, who is a computer programmer and coder. He self-categorizes himself as a geek by nature and by trade. Kenneth Dubroff, yeah, you and join us in studio. Thanks so much. And of course, you're the force behind the nuclearterrortoday.org website. We are also joined in studio today, I should say rejoined, by a longtime ally and stellar activist, Robert Manning. So, Robert Manning, you have been around the Project Censored Show for a long time. You were a firefighter for almost 30 years and a fire captain. Right. You know, really just a history of being a community person. And, of course, as an activist, right? Going back to the first Gulf War in 1991, you also joined Greenpeace. You also work with the Gundersons, the people at Fairwinds. And you've been with us on the program before. Last year, I recall you talking to me a little bit about this endeavor. So you started this project with Ken, who is your grandson. So it's a family affair.
Family affair.
That multiple generations, you're fighting nuclear terror today. So what inspired you to create this movement, this project? Tell us a little bit about where this came from. What's the genesis for nuclear terror today?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It gets started with reading the 2017 book written by Daniel Ellsberg, who's of Pentagon Papers fame. And the title of the book is The Doomsday Machine. It's a very powerful book, and it goes into the history of modern warfare. And in addition, it goes into nuclear weapons and the evolution of nuclear weapons and where it is today and where it possibly will be going. So in addition to that, I had a conversation, face-to-face conversations with Daniel and his wife, Patricia, and they inspired me to start this project. And so it kind of grew from there, and it's becoming more and more powerful every day.
Our listeners, of course, know Daniel Ellsberg, as you mentioned, from Pentagon Papers fame. But Ellsberg has always been pretty outspoken about his anti-war stances, in particular his concern about nuclear weaponry.
In fact, well, he worked for the RAND Corporation.
Right.
And I don't know how much people know about some of his history, but he was under President Kennedy. He was the third person under Robert McNamara. He was right there during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and so Daniel has all kinds of experience in regards to the creation of nuclear weapons and their evolution.
And, of course, our listeners are likely familiar with Dan Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine. That's the one that Robert Manning just referenced. It's The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. It's described as a real-life Dr. Strangelove story and an ultimately hopeful and powerfully important book about not just our country, but the future of the world. Chase?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, what is the exact goal of your movement and of your organization? Is it to rid all of the world of nuclear weapons? What exactly would you like to see happen or start happening today?
We don't expect any country to get rid of their nuclear weapons. That's not going to happen in probably my lifetime. Hopefully, maybe someday, but who knows when. The objective that we have is for people to go to the website, first of all. We have three pledges on there, on the website. And the first pledge is for all nuclear weapons nations to declare they will not attack first with nuclear weapons. Number two is to take all ICBM missiles off a hair trigger alert. And number three is to create nuclear weapons treaties / space treaties with, very important, unannounced inspections. So those are the objectives. When people go to the website, that's what they will see on the website. So once they go to the website, the next thing is to take the pledge that's on there and also reference to their congressional representatives, a pledge for them. This is totally unique. This has never been done before, to our knowledge, of having government, national government representatives like senators and representatives in the House to take a pledge, and it's specifically about nuclear weapons. And the third pledge is from us, to be totally ethical and protect your information as best technically in today's world as possible. So those are the things that we're trying to shoot for here.
So past to present, let's talk a little bit about that, right? I mean, people of a certain age remember ducking and covering under desks at schools, somehow right. going to save us all.
Bomb shelters.
Right, right. Fallout shelters, etc. So what's so different about the problem today? I mean, one of them that comes to mind is that I was born in the 1970s. I remember the end of the Cold War and those drills and the propaganda films, Red Dawn, and right. you know, all that stuff. Right. So tell us a little, what's different? Past strategy, what about today? I mean, other than the fact that it seems to be off of a lot of people's radar, but the threat hasn't dissipated.
Of course not. What it used to be officially was MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. That's what's been in place as a strategy since the 1950s, actually. And it truly didn't provide any defense even then. What's going on right now is that the evolution of nuclear weapons is in all fields. Submarines, drones, artificial intelligence, it's scary. And so what we're trying to do, once again, is have people go to the website, www.nuclearterrortoday.org, and begin the process. Take the pledge. Pass it on to 10 more people, and we'll go from there, because it's going to get worse. We even now have, believe it or not, a drone nuclear destroyer. A drone destroyer. Let's go back a little bit. Does everyone remember the Challenger? And what it turned out to be is a washer. The fuel tank separated, but it was due originally to a very small piece. I believe it was a washer. And what happened is 7 astronauts got killed. Why I bring that up is because we're depending on equipment that has the possibility of failing. And what will happen is that millions of people will die. People think that they don't have any chance. So what we're trying to do is create a miracle, because there have been miracles in the past. The first miracle came from citizens up, from the bottom up. And that was when they were testing in the atmosphere and testing in the oceans. We no longer do that. So why is that possible? What happened was that when they found radioactive particles in women's breast milk, then everyone got upset, rich, poor, whatever, in regards to this is going into our bodies and our children's bodies. So they got active and got out there, and we no longer test in the atmosphere or the oceans. There's other miracles that have happened, miracles such as the fall of the Berlin Wall, miracles such as one person stopping nuclear attack.
Stanislav Petrov.
Right, yeah. Right. And not only that, there's not many people know that there were 2 Russian submarines during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Each had 1 nuclear torpedo on their submarines. They were chosen, the personnel on those submarines chose not to fire the torpedoes. They were later court-martialed. Even Petrov was court-martialed later. So, once again, it...
Unsung heroes and people that you'd think should be household names that most folks don't recall or have never heard of.
Right. Well, here's a couple of names that they have heard of. We're citing the miracle of Nelson Mandela, which ended apartheid in South Africa, which is a miracle, and plus the fall of the Berlin Wall. So what we're trying to do is have people believe that we all can create another miracle today, because we can.
I'd like to remind listeners that you are tuned to the Project Censored show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. And on the program today, we are talking to Kenneth Dubroff, who is a computer programmer and coder, and he's the force behind the website of the topic we're discussing today. We're talking also with Robert Manning, longtime activist, and we're talking about the ongoing threat of nuclear annihilation and the nuclear terror today. You can learn more at the website nuclearterrortoday.org. And after this brief musical break, we will continue our conversation. Please stay with us.
I love my classes. I got a crazy teacher. He wears dark glasses. Things are going great, and they're only getting better. I'm doing all right, getting good grades. The future's so bright. I gotta wear shades. I gotta wear shades. I got a job waiting for my graduation.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we're joined by Kenny Dubrov and Robert Manning. We are talking about nuclear terror today. The website is nuclearterrortoday.org. And just prior to that break, we were talking about historic threats. We were talking about past threats, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Chase?
Yeah, on the website, it briefly mentions that there is no defense for us today. Obviously, we've talked about how some of the military equipment used with the nuclear missiles and warheads are deteriorating over time. But what do you really mean by that, there is no defense today?
So there really has never been any defense. But today, the situation is much worse than it's ever been. We have continuous development of nuclear weapons. There's drones that are nuclear-armed now, nuclear-powered. Russia's got a drone submarine, in fact, that dirties the water as it travels with nuclear radiation. The United States has 14 Ohio-class submarines that carry 192 nuclear warheads apiece on 24 ICBMs.
And that would destroy how many Earths?
If one launched its entire payload, would cause nuclear winter and destroy 99% of human life.
So that's where we wanted to go with this, is the fallout issue, right? What could happen if there were a nuclear exchange, a nuclear weapons exchange, or an accident?
So what happens is nuclear winter, and probably not many people know what that means. What happens is 70% of the sun is blocked out for a decade, 10 years. So what happens is everyone dies, even if they have a shelter. Because there's not going to be any food, all the animals are going to be contaminated or dead. It's the end of life as we know it, period. It's expected that 99% of all human beings will die. So this is another reason why, we've already pointed out a few, why we're trying to create a miracle. And once again, what that is, it takes effort. And some of it is overwhelming, but we've already pointed out miracles that happened in the past. So now it's time for us to work together and create another miracle.
So just to clarify, is that if one nuclear warhead were to go off, or is that the kind of mutually assured destruction scenario where one attacks another country and then the other country responds? That 70% of the sun being blocked out, is that just one nuclear?
No, that's not just one nuclear weapon. It's what we said, what Kenny was pointing out, is one Ohio-class submarine that the United States has. We have 14 of them. One, for sure, if it launches, it has 24 missiles on it. Each one of those has 8 nuclear warheads that can be launched independently from the missile. And that one submarine, for sure, can kill and devastate everyone in Europe, just one. We have 14 of them. Russia has 11. China, our latest information, has 4. What I'm trying to say here is it's getting worse and worse and worse as time goes on. It's really ridiculous. You know, we're spending close to trillions of dollars in regards to supposedly create national security, and there really is none. You know, an accident could happen tomorrow. So once again, go to our website and join us.
You know, Robert Manning, just again, just reminded me, historically speaking, going back to the 50s, going back to the Truman Doctrine and the Eisenhower years and the mutually assured destruction, it reminded me of one of Eisenhower's quotes, right? Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. The world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete highway. We pay for a single fighter plane with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. Of course, this is in 1950s time, but I mean, you see where he's going. Right? And this is a World War II general, Republican president, right? He goes on, we pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This, I repeat, is the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. This is some pretty serious talk from a Republican president and war general coming out of World War II.
Definitely is. In fact, his farewell speech, I believe,
1961,
is where he pointed out is that we should be concerned about the military-industrial complex. So what happens is that I don't know who cited this, but the objective of the defense industry is to have representatives in every congressional district that lobby Congress for more and more money in regards to more and more weaponry of some sort. But what we're focusing on is nuclear weapons. And what we want to do is give people hope that things can change and we can work together and create a miracle.
So Mickey just read a somewhat scary letter there, but we had a scare of our own in the United States recently with the Hawaii missile scare, with the warning going out. I saw that you featured that story on your website. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I would love everyone to use their imagination and try to picture yourself being there. January 13th, 2018, there were over a million people that thought they were going to die. The Hawaii missile scare lasted for 38 minutes, and all the means of communication was repeating over and over again that you had the possibility of dying. So if you could picture yourself there, as we point out in the video, it's a four-minute video. First of all, it's disbelief. Next comes panic. What do I do? Where do I go? How can I protect my family? We even show very briefly parents trying to put their child into a manhole. I mean, you know, that's beyond comprehension. If it was me, I don't know what I would do. There was even one person that went with his significant other to Waikiki Beach and ended up having a heart attack and almost died. And now he's suing the state of Hawaii and Hawaii Emergency Management Agency.
Because this was a mistake, this was human error,
right,
and someone had pushed the wrong button.
That's right.
That's how simple it is to make an error.
Right. But once again, it's not entirely direly. I mean, it is a dangerous situation. We totally agree with that. But join us. Please go to www.nuclearterrortoday.org, and let's work together and create a miracle.
And so you say, again, you invite people to check out your pledges and your challenges. And again, one of the things that we just got into here that Chase brought up was, in addition to these pledges, you're highlighting the Hawaii missile scare as a very real, tangible, and extraordinarily recent event that does trigger people old enough to remember. So some of these people that are reacting to this, that's part of it. They're saying, this is it.
Right.
This is the end.
This is it.
And I had read stories from people, a lot of social media people were posting. They were saying, hey, what's going on? I mean, people in you know, the mainland, so to speak, were trying to get a hold of people in Hawaii and say, hey, we don't know. We don't know what you're talking about. I mean, it was confusing and chaotic and extraordinarily hair-raising.
I'll share something about my past. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, I was working 96 hours a week, working at day and night to support my family. And during that crisis, I believed that it was over myself, because President Kennedy said those ships are not going to go through with those missiles that are on there to resupply Cuba. And Khrushchev said, well, they are going through. In fact, his ambassador to the United Nations, Russia's ambassador to the United Nations at that time, said those ships are going through, period. So I decided not to go to work the next day, to go home and be with my family. So what happened, I was working for PG&E at the time. I went to work the following day, you know, because things were averted, naturally. They said, we can't pay you for that. And I said, okay.
Yeah. I was busy thinking it was all over.
Right. So that's kind of a comparison here, you know. But once again, we're here to project hope also.
Well, that's your vision of the future, right. Clearly here, is that you're not defeatist. Yeah. Kenny, you're a grandson of Robert and have kids of your own.
Yes.
Right? Great. So that's a pretty motivating factor.
Most definitely, yeah.
So that was the main impetus,
That was my main motivation to begin with.
So are you talking to other parents? Are you talking to other people in your peer groups about this kind of thing? Because maybe it's not necessarily on the radar of people under 40.
The problem when I talk about it is I know too much. I know too many details. People don't want to hear it. People get scared. They get overwhelmed.
Well, what do you think about the website Nuclear Terror Today does, pun intended, disarms people? what do you think about it? What made you as a web designer do what you did with the site, with the imagery and how it works? Because you just described the problem that we face at Project Censored all the time. Mm-hmm. How do you talk to people? And we don't only talk about Doomsday and Henny Penny and all that. We also talk about other things and positive things and so forth. But we do talk about a lot of things that are very heavy and have potential for significant consequences. And some people are like, hey, TMI, that's like too much information. Right. It's wrecking my program. You know, a lot of people around the world don't have a choice of whether or not something's wrecking their program because it's just their part of their daily experience. So tell us a little bit about how you put this together as someone that designs this. I mean, what are you hoping to achieve when people come here to nuclearterrortoday.org? Because the name Nuclear Terror Today, well, that's a little edgy, right? Oh, I don't know if I want to know that. But when you go here, you have a really powerful imagery. So tell us a little about that.
We went through a couple versions of the website. Mm-hmm. The first one was more harrowing. It was more about the dangers and less about what you can do. Although that was our focus, we didn't really show it. I started watching motivational speakers on YouTube for some reason. I came across a man named Simon Sinek.
Start with why.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. And that was the premise behind the website, is starting with why we're doing this, not with the most dangerous outcome.
Right, not hitting people in the face with all the information, which is what we would be doing at Project Censored, exactly. Which is why I don't design the website.
Well, here's what inspired me, to tell you the truth, was Daniel and Patricia.
Ellsberg.
Daniel Ellsberg, yes. Because 90% of what has been created came from talks with him and his wife. He was the one who came up with the miracles. He was the one who came up with the three challenges, you know, in regards to challenge for citizens, challenge for the representatives, and challenge for us. He came up with those. So it's an evolving process that it all came up. But once again, even Daniel Ellsberg was holding out hope, and that's what we're holding out, because if we all join together, you know, we can create a miracle. It has been done before. It can happen again.
I think that's a really important thing to remember, and again, appreciate all of the efforts that the two of you have been putting into this. Again, the website is nuclearterrortoday.org. You can look at the pledges there. You can share it through social media, and of course, you can see a little bit more about some of the things that we just talked about on the program today. So as we're wrapping up this segment, Robert Manning, any last words here for you?
We're very happy to announce that Peter Coyote narrated our video for us. He has a zany, beautiful approach. He's a beautiful human being, and he consented to narrate the video and also to allow us to put his name on the video.
And you can see the video by going to the website. And Kenny, how about you? Concluding remarks?
Just go to the website, take the pledge, share it on Facebook. It's all we can ask right now.
Well, Robert Manning, it's always a pleasure to see you, and you're always sort of feeding some things to us here at the show, ideas for programs, and of course, your own activist work inspired by Dan Ellsberg's Doomsday Machine. Kenny DeBroff, was wonderful to meet you, and glad you could come up here, and thanks for all the good work that you're doing. With that, again, nuclearterrortoday.org to find out more.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself, Mickey Huff, with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer and host of the program. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer, and our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your phone or smart tablet's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. And last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Right with waves full of poison, genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens, and the times for the master thief combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the main.